Hello, and welcome to episode 66 of Thacy Books. News and views about Thacy literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Butt. Thank you for tuning in. In today's Thacy Craft Chat, we have Wajahat Ali discussing his new memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From. In this conversation, we talked about how he used gut-punching humor to tell a story about living with one foot in the American dream and one in the American nightmare, and much more. Wajahat Ali is a Daily Beast columnist, a public speaker, a recovering attorney, and a frequent political commentator on television and podcasts. His essays, interviews, and reporting have appeared in The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Guardian, and New York Review of Books. He believes in sharing stories that are by us, for everyone. Universal narratives told through a culturally specific lens to entertain, educate, and bridge the global divides. Go Back to Where You Came From takes its title from just one of the many warm, lovely, and helpful tips that Ali and other children of immigrants receive on a daily basis. Go back to where exactly? Fremont, California, where he grew up, but is now an unaffordable place to live? Or Pakistan, the country his parents left behind a half century ago? Growing up, living the suburban American dream, young Wajahat devoured comic books, which were devoid of brown superheroes, and fielded well-intentioned advice from uncles and aunties on becoming a doctor. He had turmeric stains under his fingernails, was accident-prone, suffered from OCD, and wore husky pants. But he was as American as his neighbors, with roots all over the world. Then, while Ali was studying at the University of California in Berkeley, 9/11 happened. Muslims replaced communists as America's enemy number one, and he became an accidental spokesman and ambassador of all ordinary, non-threatening things Muslimy. Now a middle-aged dad, Ali has become one of the foremost and funniest public intellectuals in America. In Go Back to Where You Came From, he tackles the dangers of Islamophobia, white supremacy, and chocolate hummus, peppering personal stories with astute insights into national security, immigration, and pop culture. In this bold, hopeful, and uproarious memoir, Ali offers indispensable lessons for cultivating a more compassionate, inclusive, and delicious America. I reviewed this book for NPR last month, and I'll just read a little bit from it. The book begins on a highly amusing note as a response to Islamophobic hate mail and maintains a bitingly humorous tone throughout as a faux guide to becoming a true American. Yet, Ali's coming-of-age experiences as a brown Muslim man are anything but hilarious. What emerges from these vulnerable and witty accounts of personal ups and downs is a larger picture of America's troubled, complex relationship with brown, Muslim, and immigrant communities. Ali doesn't pull any punches when expressing his righteous anger against things like the moderate Muslim trope, mass incarceration, systemic racism, socioeconomic inequality, and more. Scathing political commentary about both Republicans and Democrats is supported with requisite data and historical facts, and he seasons all of that skillfully with comedy and popular cultural references from the US and Pakistan, and a deeply warm affection for the family and friends who've always been there for him. among other things. We also discussed Ali's now famous play, The Domestic Crusaders, which he wrote when he was just 21 in college. And so that can be downloaded now from McSweeney's, and it will be linked on the website. And here's Wajahat Ali now. Hi, Wajahat, and welcome to Desi Books on the Desi Craft Chat segment. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Jenny, for having me. And thank you for being a nerd and a Desi who actually reads books and makes money doing so. You have given other young brown nerds hope.
I hope so. And I hope your book will as well, as we'll get into it and talk about it. Let's start with, I always ask this question because I'm very curious about this as a writer myself, which is the moment of commitment, the moment that you decided you had to write this particular book. You know, you've been writing columns and op-eds and other essays, right? So this is a book-length memoir. So could you maybe tell us a little bit about that?
That's a very good question. So I'll answer you actually, before you asked about the specific book, I was also interested in the first part of your question, the commitment to writing. And if you don't mind, I'll connect both. I think it's interesting when you kind of write, you know, I started writing, you know, this play, this Domestic Crusaders, when I was a 21-year-old senior at UC Berkeley. And my professor at the time, Ishmael Reed, everyone knows Ishmael Reed, you know, MacArthur Genius winner, brilliant writer and poet. He was my professor who said, you should write, you have a talent, and you should write a play. And I was in a short story writing class, Jenny. So I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, just don't waste your time with the short stories. You know, dialogue and characters are your strengths. Write me this play. And, you know, I'm a Black man, and we have survived in America for 400 years by writing. Writing is a fighting, he said. We, you know, they try to erase us, but we fight back through art and culture. And I'm looking at South Asians and Muslims in the media. And I think you guys are going to get hazed for the next 10 years. This was right after 9/11. And so he said, you should write a story about an American family, but it happens to be Muslim and Pakistani. So I started that at 21 and I finished that at 23. And even though we staged the play, produced it, I still didn't accept that I was a writer, Jenny. You know, I didn't. And it took me a while. And I remember my director, Carla Blank, eventually, I think I was 27. She goes, listen, you write, you get paid to write. You write something, they send you a check, you cash it in, you're a writer. So to even acknowledge that I was a writer took me a long time. And this was after, like you said, the columns. You know, I had written columns and I had written the play and people kind of saw me on TV. But it's just one thing where you feel like, not necessarily that you're a fraud, but like, do I have the right to call myself a writer? Like, I've only written one play. I've only written a couple of columns. So that commitment to write and to call yourself and name yourself a writer is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to a book, similarly, I was like, you know, who am I? Should I write a book? There's so many books out there, Jenny. There's so many podcasts. Like, mekonu, I'm just a regular Joe. This was me like at the age of like 39, like a year and a half ago. And I remember my agent has been after me for 9 years to write a book, almost 10 years now. And there's something about turning 40. I remember the same thing happened to me when I was about to turn 30. You have like this premature midlife crisis and you do an audit of your life and you're like, I'm going to die. I haven't done anything useful. And I was about to turn 40. It was a pandemic. My daughter had survived stage 4 cancer. All the warnings that we tried to warn this country about what was happening with white supremacy and the death rattle of white supremacy, Trumpism was coming to fruition. And I felt like, you know what? This is the time to write this story. And maybe I could tell a story of America, a story of identity, a story of belonging through a culturally specific lens. And maybe, maybe, just maybe, it could be healing and restorative for people, but maybe it could chart a narrative about how this country can expand, include, and include the rest of us, especially as democracy is under assault. And so I wrote the first draft, believe it or not, 120,000 words. Don't worry, the book is not that long. It eventually came out to 85,000 words in 3 months. So people say, oh, it took 3 months to write the book. And I say, no, it actually took 40 years.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of interesting things you said there. Obviously, the age 40, I think that's a big milestone, you know, for a lot of us. I gave up my corporate job in Silicon Valley, actually, at age 40 as well. And what you just said about owning yourself as a writer or owning that label, I think also in Desi culture, perhaps that's a little harder for us because it's not seen as a serious profession. And you talk about that in the book as well, and I'll get to that. I think the play part was also very interesting. I do have a question coming up about the play. But I want to come. So you you told us about the moment when you decided, okay, this is the time I'm going to write the book. You've obviously, you know, even in those 40 years, as you've described in the book, you know, there was a lot that happened. There's a lot that took place in your life, which, you know, I touch upon some of that in the review as well. But then you've taken this kind of this faux guidebook approach, right? Which is kind of funny, but yet it's serious. How did you decide on that style? Is that something that you just thought, okay, it's going to have to be this way, or?
Yeah, I wanted to not, you know, no disrespect to those writers who do that, and that's their style, and it's very effective. The type of like traditional, you know, once upon a time narrative, oftentimes it can be a bit navel-gazing, and you can be a bit restricted in the way you use humor and satire. So I wanted to be a bit subversive with the format and see if I could just flip it and have some fun with it. And the title of the book is a gut punch. Go back to where you came from. And other helpful recommendations on how to become American is my type of response, tongue in cheek, of this can-do spirit in America, where you just have to pull yourself up from the bootstraps and there's a manual for everything. And nowadays, thanks to the wellness industry, if you just follow 5 steps and 10 steps, Jenny, you too can be anything you want. Just follow these steps and you'll be perfect and you'll be happy. So I thought, what better way to convey just life, which is filled with both pain and joy? What better way to convey my life, which has, as you know, has, I've had one foot in the American dream and one foot in the American nightmare, but also how to convey the tone of the book, where, like you said, there's going to be humor and satire, but it'll be very pointed and there'll be some blunt truths and sadness. And I thought the title could capture it. Mm-hmm. And then I thought the format that I created can be a Trojan horse for me to tell the story of America as kind of like a self-help manual through 10 chapters, and in a way subvert how you can also tell a memoir and be creative with it, come at it from an askew angle where people are okay then with me doing a moderate Muslim checklist, or the people then are okay with me starting off the book with just hate mail, which like, no one, I don't think anyone's done that before. I just thought it'd be very, you know, a fun thing to do. And then right there, like the book takes off like a rocket. And like I said in the book, and I'll say to your listeners, if you don't like the book, that's fine. But I think it's unforgivable to bore an audience. So hopefully I don't bore you.
No. I think what the reason it works so well, it's so effective, is because if you had taken just a straight route, just a straight face route, there's a lot of heavy stuff then. It would have become a little weighty. But I think you've balanced, you know, you've given us, as you said, the American nightmare and the American dream, and you've given us both. But you've done it in a way that gives us enough food for thought, but doesn't kind of just weigh us down at the end of everything. And I thought that was very well done. I mean, it kept the pages going. So I thought that was great. And I do want to talk about, I'm going to ask you in a little bit about the reception so far to the book.
Sure.
But before I get there, I want to talk about that play that you mentioned, you know, Ishmael Reed. Now, I actually went and I was able to download the entire script because it's out there on McSweeney's site. I'll link it to, you know, for our listeners as well. But in the book, you wrote about how the play came about, how you did those staged readings at the local Desi restaurant. I loved how your dad went and renegotiated the price. And then
true story.
Yeah, it's great. And then you took it to New York City. And in the play itself, which I'll link to, the conversations that are happening between the family members. Now, they're pretty loaded too. And even though there's, you know, humor there, the conversations are serious. They're about racism. They're about political divides. They're about the immigrant culture and immigrant life. And so these are weighty things to have alongside your dinner. So my first question related to the play is, do you have any memorable responses that you got from the audiences when that play first? I mean, you were 20 something years old. And
Yeah. So several, I'll run the gamut very quickly. From some white influencers within our industry, what will the mainstream think? Can you make the characters relatable? Will you put a white person in the play, in your next play? Can you take away all the Urdu and the Arabic that makes people uncomfortable? Can you add a glossary? One person said, you know, the part towards the end where there was the fighting, that was the good part. Can you put more fighting in it? Like kind of this torture porn, right? Like this was again, 2002, three, four, five, right? They love stories of Muslim suffering, right? Brown people suffering, specifically brown men beating up brown women and then a white man coming and saving the brown woman, right?
Yeah.
So that was from the mainstream establishment. Or my favorite, I love your play. I'm a producer in Hollywood. I want to bring it to LA. Have you thought about casting? I'm like, not really. You know who you should cast as the Pakistani immigrant father? I'm like, who? Ted Danson. And I right. started laughing. And he's like, what's so funny? I'm like, really? You're serious? He goes, Americans love Ted Danson. And so that was 2003. You know, people forget that you and me even talking on a podcast or you having a review on NPR, that would be a big deal in 2007, 2008, Jenny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Jenny Butt.
I know, because I used to pitch even back then and I'd get no's. So,
Jenny
yeah.
Butt reviewing a book written by Wajahat Ali, published by Norton and NPR.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way that would happen is if literally no books were released that month. And they literally were desperately craving for some, you know, space. And then they're like, all right, we got this Jenny Butt, whatever. Just review this Brownie's book. Just get it in my face. Here's some money. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how it was. So we forget that. And then for Desis, it's in this book, I'm self-critical as well. I talk about my own communities. What was so fascinating about when you internalize being the other, you self-police yourself all the time without realizing it. And so the responses were fantastic, standing ovations, right? And after every performance, there would always be some Desi, South Asian uncle and auntie, Berta, but what do the people think? I'm like, what do you mean? The people were here. Nay, the people. Translation, do white people like it? And then once I got Emma Thompson's blessing, that's a great story of how yeah. I got her to read the play. Then it was like blessed by whiteness. Does that make sense? Then they exhale. They're like, oh, TK, whew, the whites like it. That must mean it's good.
Yeah, I remember reading that. And I actually debated whether to put that in the review. And then I ended up going with Toni Morrison instead. But yeah, I mean, that whole journey of the play, I got to share this little thing with you about that, because I actually shared some little clips of your book to kind of, you know, to my friends on Facebook and Twitter, and said, you know, you've got to go out and read this book. And one of the things I shared was how you did this thing at the local Desi restaurant with the dinner dining experience, and how you said somewhere that, you know, we need to flood the market with these, you know, nuanced books, which are not pandering to stereotypes and tropes. Mm. And a whole bunch of Desi writers came in, and it became this big debate, I got to tell you, which is, the debate was that, well, you know, Desi people, our own community, they don't buy and support our books.
That's right.
And this became a whole discussion that, you know, one writer, she's Pakistani-American, she says, well, you know, I was invited to a lot of book clubs for my own Desi book clubs with my book. And you know what they did? They bought one copy and passed it around to 15 people.
Stretching that dollar. Well done.
Yes,
that economic
exactly.
can-do spirit. You got to respect it also.
You got to respect it to a point. But the thing, so my thing is, you know, I don't like to simplify it. I think there are many reasons why Desi people in the US may not read books. Some of it has to do with how books aren't marketed to them properly. Our books are still marketed to white mainstream audiences. The other thing is, sometimes they don't get the kinds of books they want, because, you know, the books are pandering to stereotypes and tropes. And you mentioned this, you talked about the modern Muslim, or, you know, the moderate Muslim trope and that sort of thing. So the easily digestible stories up till very recently, and even now, I would say mainstream literary fiction, especially, not so much nonfiction, fiction tends to be a lot of publishers wanting books that will sell to a larger diverse audience. And what they mean by that is, it needs to translate to white readers.
That's
as well.
always you know? that's it. I'm like, just say it. Yeah. What you're saying is white, but they never say that. Mainstream is code word for white.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it generated quite a bit of debates. I just wanted to kind of just share.
No, but you know what's so interesting? That's the struggle, right, for many South Asian artists. It's because we don't have the numbers, and within our communities, I haven't tracked it, but it's true. If you rely purely on the biryani circuit, you're gonna starve to death and die. And what the balance was for me was I wrote culturally specific and authentic tales by us for everyone. And I tested it. And credit to my team, my director, Carla Blank, as of Russian Jewish background, my first producer was my professor, Ishmael Reed. And he said, first, try this out in front of your community that mocks you and laughs at you. Mm-hmm. You know, because I wanted to prove to them that our stories have value, our stories have worth, mm-hmm. that our stories can and will be respected and praised by diverse audiences. Because that's what happens. People say, another comment I got, why will anyone care about the story? Why will anyone care about brown folks? Why will anyone care about the daughter who wears hijab? Or this is just the stuff we talk about. Mm-hmm. We don't value the gems within our own culture at all. We just dismiss them. Yeah. Or we render it invisible, right? And so I did it in front of my community at Mehran, Pakistani Indian restaurant, and I got that standing ovation. And they're like, huh, look at that. People came out. That was wonderful. And then I've always written for diverse global audiences, Deepa, always. I'm an American. If you're a hyphenated American like the rest of us, mm-hmm. we have to be more sophisticated than the average white Joe. In fact, I will say that I'm more translatable and mainstream than the average white man because I can speak in different cultures and different languages. Yes. I have to not only succeed as an American, but also as a brown American. Mm-hmm. I have to learn how to play to the center and to the margins. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we code switch all the time, right? That's a skill we just have because we have to do it. We have no choice.
Yeah. And so we actually have a greater finger on the pulse of diversity and the mainstream, I would argue, than the people who come from these culturally isolated cocoons where they don't have those skills because they were never forced to adopt those skills. They were never forced to evolve. They always played to whiteness, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so once that, you know, this book in particular, you could see also I used the Urdu and the English mm-hmm. and the culture and the language and the religion. But if what I've seen, the last thing I'll say is if you give them a culturally specific tale, it resonates with authenticity. Like think of a meal. Mm-hmm. Does your Gora white friend want the bland biryani? Or when you give them the good stuff, they're like, why were you holding out on me, man?
Yeah.
And so I always have faith in the audience. I feel like you don't always have to hold their hand. You can give them the mirch and the masala. And once you do, they're very appreciative.
Yeah. Like everything, you know, they'll acquire the taste for it, but you've got to give it to them. So yeah.
Exactly.
Let's come to, there's a couple of things that are in the book that I want to talk about. And then we'll talk about how this book, the reception of this book as well, you know, coming to your parents' incarceration, that just broke my heart. And I'm sure it will for a lot of others. Now in the book, of course, you say very fairly that it is their story to tell. And so what you've shared is the way that it shaped your own life, but not necessarily all the details, which totally fair. But there's one sentence that stuck with me, and I've heard this in other places as well, and I wondered if you could unpack this for our listeners, which is, prison made them realize they were actually always closer to blackness. So maybe if you could just unpack that, because, you know, I've heard it from other people, and I think it's a very important point.
Yeah, so the first draft of the book was 125 or 130,000 words, which my editor and my wife who read it said it would still work really well. But my editor said, you know, just trim it. And you didn't want to go into the details. You get in the woods of the case. And then the more you do, it becomes like I'm defensive. And I don't think I was defensive. I thought that was very fair in the book. And I interviewed them and they read the book and they said, you know, go forth and publish it. So because memoir oftentimes is type of a theft, where, you know, when you add different characters in the story, they don't have the agency to tell their story. So oftentimes what you hear is there's the truth, there's your truth, and then there's my version of the truth, right? And that's what happens sometimes in a book and in a memoir. And so there's a chapter in the book where I talk about how the American dream becomes the American nightmare after 9/11. First 9/11 happens, it shatters the model of minority stereotype. If any Muslim immigrant at that time thought they were white, this country reminded you, nope, you're the other. You're them. You're the axis of evil. And then a few months later, my parents were arrested. And overnight, here were these, you know, suburban Pakistani immigrant parents, upper middle class, I would say, you know, had money, they lost money, they had money, they lost money, not FU rich, but they had the suburban home and they had the Honda and the American dream, right? There was ups and downs in life, but nothing like this. And overnight, I had the foot in the American nightmare where both my parents were incarcerated. I had no money. I had to take care of my grandparents because my grandmothers, because I was the only child. We lost the home. We lost the assets. We lost the community. We lost the friends. We lost everything. My mom said it best. Everything turned to dust. And that American nightmare represents the lived experience of so many Black and Brown Americans, so many poor people in this country, because this country incarcerates more people than any other country on earth. And overnight, I think my parents realized, even though if they did not articulate it, that no matter how good we were, no matter, you know, they went to the good schools and they had the good house and they had the good son who went to UC Berkeley. Overnight, this country can turn on you on a dime and you'll never be white. You'll be the other. And from that moment on, we tasted the Black experience. Ah, that's what it's like to be the other. Oh, we have always been closer to Blackness and brownness than whiteness. Oh, we should have actually made alliances with Black and Brown communities. Oh, this is the multicultural coalition of the willing. Ah, I see. And we only were able to see it. Some of us were only able to see it once the door to the American dream was violently shut and we were kicked out.
Yeah, no, that was that whole, the way you've kind of woven in what was going on, because it went on for a long period of time.
10 years.
Yeah, it's just, I can't even imagine. That's a good chunk of somebody's life. You know,
it was my entire 20s. You know, I talk about it in the book without giving too much away, but it's fine. We could talk about it. They first got arrested, Jenny, and then nobody would come near. You know how it is in Desi. Yeah. Any community politics, they're like, "Lo kya bolenge? What will people say?"
Yeah.
And for a year, they were stuck because I couldn't raise the money because the government took over my property. I had no money. So they were stuck because I couldn't raise the bail money. And then they got out. They appealed the case because they said, why should we accept guilt over something we don't think we did? And then they felt like the 30 count indictment was just harsh and wrong. And so I said, okay, I can understand and appreciate that if someone had accused me of something, it's my name. It's like that scene in Crucible. Give me my name.
Yes.
And so they appealed that case. That case was appealed for 8 years. And so imagine now, I graduate from law school, I've written a play, but still I'm paralyzed because any second, what could happen, Jenny? They lose the appeal, and then what happens? You get shattered again. And that's what happened. After a decade, almost a decade, they lost the appeal. My parents went to jail. My mom went to jail right before I turned 30. And then they stayed in jail for nearly 4 years. And while everyone thought I was killing it, Wajahat Ali, the guy who made it, I had the foot in the American nightmare.
Yeah. That's just, I mean, beyond, I would not even wish that on an enemy. So, you know, for you guys to all have come through, I'm just, yeah, it's amazing. But, you know, speaking about the, you know, how their experience was closer to Blackness, I want to come to Obama, because, you know, you've talked about him in your columns, you've written about him in this book too. You described him in here as Etch-a-Sketch, and everyone had such high hopes. And then, especially with the second term, we kind of saw that a lot of those hopes were to do more with our projection onto him rather than the reality.
So,
go ahead.
No, I called him the Etch-a-Sketch president, right? And he didn't, like, when people say, oh, he disappointed me, he never disappointed me because he performed exactly like how he thought he'd perform, a center-left candidate trying his best to navigate white anxiety over the fact that they elected a Muslim man to the highest office of the land. You can never be angry. And even if he could be angry, that wasn't his disposition, right? He's a man who grew up in Indonesia and also in America and also mostly with his white family. So he was able, in a way, to be magical. He saw the good whites and he said, look, they accepted me, right? And he gave those speeches to Black folks. Just pull yourself up, you know, those responsibility speeches that he gave. Yeah. Because he witnessed a type of multicultural dream that many people still haven't, right? Mm-hmm. He lived in a way that where he was accepted by the white side of his family. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's not that he's ignorant about it. I don't think so. But I feel like sometimes that was a blind spot for Obama that he thought he could charm the Republicans and win them over. And I'm like, yo, Mitch McConnell is literally telling you, my only goal is to make you a one-term president. They hate you, Obama. Yeah. You're Black. They think you're Muslim, which then became a really good litmus test for us. We're like, oh, crap. They hate him because he's Muslim. He's not even Muslim.
Yeah,
What does that say about us? What do they think about us? Like, we're like herpes, right? We're like kryptonite. Yeah. And so for me, he behaved the way I thought he would behave. But for so many people, you know, they thought Obama, just like now, everyone wants a Superman to come in and save the day. And you realize, oh my God, the problems are deeper. The problems are structural. And everyone has to invest in this fight. You can't just outsource it. And I think they wanted to outsource it to Obama as a superhero.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is Obama was the first US president I voted for because I had just gotten naturalized. as a citizen. Mm. And so he was the first. So for me, it was a kind of a big deal, right? I'm voting for the first US president who happens to be Black. And I don't know. And then, you know, you watched carefully how all this played out, and it was interesting. So I got to ask you, looking at the new regime with Biden and Harris, here's a Desi Black woman. I don't know. Sometimes she calls herself Black American. Sometimes, you know, she's
Desi.
Yeah, she's Kamala Auntie. But, you know, she was the attorney general in California when I was working there. And then she was obviously the U.S. senator there. So if I was wondering just, you know, if Obama is Etch-a-Sketch, how might you describe Biden Harris? Or is it too early to tell?
Harris,
I mean,
is invisible.
Career politicians. So, I mean, we knew what we were voting for with them, right?
Harris is invisible. I mean, really, you see Democrats catering yet again to the center, which to them is mainstream, which to them is the average American, which to them is whiteness, trying to placate white anxiety and white fear and white guilt by literally rendering the vice president invisible. They don't even support her. They don't even rally around her. They don't even batten down the hatches. Like, you have Republicans right now literally supporting Paul Gosar, a white nationalist who speaks at white supremacist conferences. You have them literally supporting Lauren Boebert, an Islamophobe. You have them doubling down for Marjorie Taylor Greene. But you see them throwing Kamala to the wolves. And it's because of her race, because she is a Black woman. You see the type of condescending interviews that and the headlines and the articles. Look, you don't have to be a fan of her. That's fine, but you haven't seen such blatant disrespect to Pence or to Cheney even. Right now they're rehabilitating Cheney and say, look, Cheney, he's such a, you know, maybe Cheney should run again. And you're like, what?
Oh my God! Yeah.
You know, and so it's because of her Blackness and because she's a woman. And I feel like the fix is in. I feel like this country hates Black women so much that she can't win. And you're already seeing in the first year, like, and I've said this, I'm like, yo, we voted for Biden Harris. We need to see her. We need to hear from her. But I feel like they're hiding her. And like what happens oftentimes with minorities, like, oh, you darkies, you're always whining and complaining. Fine, fine. Go fix immigration. And like, Kamala, go do that. Lose-lose situation. Yeah. Go fix crime, lose-lose situation, right? And then when we lose and they don't give us the resources and the support, they say, see, that's why we don't tell the darkies to do it, because they can't do it. And when they can't do it,
I know. You're set up to fail. And I think that I was worried about that. I was worried just what you just said, which is that she would be set up to fail. And I mean, it hasn't happened yet, but what's happened is what you've said, which is she's been rendered invisible. So, well,
it's frustrating, right? Regardless of your critiques of her, why is she rendered invisible? Why are the Democrats not rallying around her?
Yeah.
Why do they not do a strong push? Why have they set her up to fail? And it's because Democratic Party, I'm sorry to say, tokenizes voters of color. They get into office on our backs. And then when it comes to push comes to shove, all right, darkie, no police reform, no immigration reform, no voting rights. We'll punt that. We'll punt that second, third, fourth, never.
Yeah. Well, I hope things will get better. But, you know, to me, I thought, I mean, she was very powerful as AG in California, right? And as your senator. So, I mean, she's no wallflower. Let's hope that, I don't know, common sense will prevail, I guess.
But the way it ties to everything, right, Jenny, is the rest of us are paying attention.
Yeah.
The rest of us are paying attention. Like, oh, so this is how this country treats the first Black Desi vice president. Yeah.
Talking about paying attention, you know, I felt that one of the main messages of your book, at least for me reading it as a brown immigrant woman, Desi woman, was pay attention. Because even when you end with a message of hope in the book, that there is a better world beyond the racism and discrimination. You know, I agreed with that because it may not seem like it on many days because of 24/7 social and news media. There's always a fire somewhere. But I mean, if we trace the arc of history, and you know, things do get better if we're all more aware and active. And so my question here is, if there is one practical change that you hope this book will lead to or might lead to, what might that be?
That's a very good question. And one, look, I don't have the delusions of grandeur to assume that me, Wajahat Lee, one person of 8 billion people in this world, has the power to change anyone's mind, or a book can change someone's mind. That being said, If you look at pop culture, there is that analogy of Inception, that movie that came out with Leonardo DiCaprio, where he goes inside your brain and he spins the top and he just puts like a, as we say, a whisper, a waswasa, a whisper in your head. Maybe this book could put a whisper in your head. Maybe people read this book and their defenses come down through the humor and they're like, huh, he makes an interesting point. Yeah, you know, all these other folks, they're not trying to replace me. They just want a seat at the table. And maybe he's right, and maybe his warnings are correct, that this country won't survive if we restrict the American narrative. We have to expand it. And I might not like everything, but this is the only way my kids have a shot at the American dream. And my kids will have a shot, and Mujahid's kids will have a shot. And that's the only way. I think he might be onto something. And also, these demons and threats that we're facing are nothing new. We've seen this story before. We've seen the villains before. In fact, I remember when my Italian grandfather used to tell me that he was the invader, or my Irish Catholic grandmother. Maybe there's a better way to do business in America, and maybe I can contribute to making that better narrative. You know, if that waswasa and whisper comes into someone's brain, I feel like I have succeeded. And like I said before, I think boring an audience is a sin. If they're not bored by it, I feel like it's a double win.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's, you know, one of the reasons I do try to review books like yours is because, and I do it for venues like NPR, because I mean, I could do it just with AC Books and be sort of quiet there, but it's getting to a larger audience of people, and hopefully they'll feel like, oh, I should go read that book, and hopefully that will happen. So that's great. And let me, you know, you talk about not boring people with a book, and I got to tell you, there were parts of this book as I was reading, I was almost visualizing them as a movie on the book. And so I would love to know what's next for you. I know you're doing the book tour right now. Is the play going to Hollywood eventually without Ted Danson? is the book going to be a movie? Because we'd love to see that.
Interesting. I've tried with the book, with the play. Several people have tried. And everyone who reads the play, they said this could be, you know, made into a movie or TV series. Yeah. Let's see. But, you know, the book just came out. And right before this conversation, I had an email from someone saying exactly that. And yesterday I had a conversation with someone saying exactly that. And then 2 days ago, someone said that. Like, I never thought about it. I never wrote it to be adapted. But three different people from three different ethnicities, by the way, said, this needs to be a Netflix series. And if you can make this into a dramatized series or a version of this, it could be very powerful. They just said, like, it translates so easily. So I was like, huh, I never even thought about that. So let's see if the book takes off.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. A series is good because, you know, Mira Jacob, who I think 2 or 3 years ago, she had this graphic memoir, and, you know, she's raising a multicultural, they see American family as well. And I think hers got options for a series as well. And again, she's kind of doing what you do, which is, hers is graphic, but the thing is, you know, she does the humor as well as the seriousness, and she's trying to show a lot of the same things, you know, I mean, so I think that, I think there's definitely, I hope they'll make it a movie, because, you know, there are some people who don't read and they'd rather watch it on a screen. And I just hope that way it gets out to more people.
And you know, the reason why, like, forget if mine isn't into a movie or TV series, that's fine. But, you know, what I think we need a shift right now, because what's happening, and which is great, is that you're seeing a lot of comedy and rom-com and light stuff, which is fantastic. But some of the issues that we deal with, like, I would love for this to get some airtime, like some of the internal and external pressures. I think that will resonate with a lot of folks.
Yeah, I agree. And I think more and more people are sitting at home and watching Netflix series as well. So I think it's just the right time for a show like this to take off. So I hope it will happen, and all the best to you. My last question, and I ask this of everybody who comes on, which is, what is your favorite Desi book and why? And it could be anything. It doesn't have to be recent, but anything by a writer of South Asian origin.
Oh, but that's a really good question. And I'm going to piss off so many of my friends. I'll be as honest as I can. And right when you finished asking that question, a book popped into my head. So I'll choose that book only because it popped into my head. Okay.
Sure.
And I'll tell you why. There's a story behind it, even though I don't think it's his best book. I remember I saw Mohsen Hamid's Moth Smoke, and I was 17, at UC Berkeley with, I think, my mom and my Faiz Mamu, and we were doing orientation, right? And I was just walking around, and there was a bookstore. I was getting my books, and I saw this book on the stands. I'm like, Mohsen Hamid, that's a Desi name. That's like a Pakistani name. I'm like, what? And then I picked up the book. I'm like, what? This is like a major publisher. And I looked at the back. I'm like, what? They got these, what? The characters in Pakistan? And I remember I read it. It's a great read. But I just remember, I thought that was very powerful that like I saw that. And I was like, this was years ago. This is like 24 years ago. All right. Where I saw like a Pakistani writer writing a book with Pakistani characters in Pakistan that I picked up at UC Berkeley. And now I know Mohsen, so I won't inflate his ego, but that was something, you know, but that was something really powerful. Is it my favorite? I don't know, but it's something that I remember just stuck with me.
It's a milestone book. I mean, and you talk about Mohsen Hamid. I mean, I loved his Reluctant Fundamentalist. And, you know, as you were saying that, I was remembering he has a Toni Morrison connection because I think he studied with her.
That's right. In Princeton, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, his book, which was made into a movie by Mira Nair.
Yes.
And that had Riz Ahmed, right?
And I know Riz before he got famous.
Okay. And Riz would be great to play you in your Netflix series, right? So please make it happen. Yeah,
so, you know, the funny thing is, Mohsen, when this is the one degree of separate, if everyone's paying attention, all Desis know each other. Riz and I connected via Gmail like in 2008, and we just kept supporting each other, and then we finally did a talk in London in 2013, right after Four Lions came out, but right before he really blew up. But we had like one degree of separation, right? And I remember Mohsen, when he was talking about the book, I'm like, yo, are you excited about the movie adaptation? And he's like, about Reluctant Fundamentals, he goes, I don't know how the movie will do, but man, Riz kills it in this movie, and I think this will really help Riz, like this will help his career. So he was like, I think Riz is going to go supernova. Yeah. And that's the interesting thing. You know, now Riz has gone supernova, and Mohsen Hamid's gone supernova with Exit West and other books. Yes. And it's really cool. And then someone else said that. They're like, Wajahat, the first person who read this, a friend of mine who read this and said it should be a book, excuse me, it should be a movie. He's like, bro, I'm calling it. TV series.
Exactly. I mean, I was, while I was still reading your book, I was saying to my husband, this has to be a movie or whatever, you know, a series.
He's like, movie or TV series? Yeah. Riz is going to play you. And I'm like, bro, I think I'm way too older and fatter than Riz. So we have to find like an older, fatter version of Riz. That's the one degree of separation. And I think that's really beautiful, right? That it just also shows you how all of us kind of came up together in a way. They are, of course, are far more successful than me, but I've always rooted for them. And it also goes to show you, for those who are listening, why it's important to invest in a community of writers and artists who help each other, right? There oftentimes, and I say this in the book, because of the scarcity, we become the worst versions of ourselves. And we think there can be only one. It can only be one Desi podcast host, and I have to kill her and absorb her powers like Highlander.
I know. No. And you know what? And people ask me this, and I say I wish there were more venues like Desi Books. I don't see it as competition.
Exactly.
I don't. I want I never more have of also. Us talking about Desi Books. So yeah, I think it's.
And it's never, look, it hasn't hurt my career. Whatever was meant for me came to me. What's meant for Jenny came to Jenny. What meant for Riz went to Riz. Yeah. But what it does do is it puts more artists and more of our product and IP out there, and people say, oh, look, there's an audience for this.
Exactly.
The people will come.
And that's what I say, a rising tide lifts all boats. What we have to keep doing is raise the tide, and that will lift all our boats. If we, you know, if we play this game of, oh, me before others, then it doesn't help anyone.
And then you bring the boats close together so that we can share the same copy of the book.
Yeah.
You just pass. You pass the book from boat to boat.
Right. Yeah, that was that. I had to tell you that story because that was just cracking me up. But it's true. Anyway.
That's how our people are. We're resourceful people. We're resourceful. Let's just call it that.
No, let's call it that. Well, thank you so much. This was fun. And I'm glad that we got to chat with you in between your very busy, I'm sure, promo cycle. And this, you know, the book, again, thank you so much for writing it. And I am sending you all good vibes for this book to get either the Netflix series or the movie, whichever. And we all look forward to that. And I wish you all the very best with this and other books. I hope you'll keep writing, and obviously your columns there, which I will link to, and I will link to the play as well. So thank you again. No,
thank you, Jenny. Thank you for being a wonderful voice of support, and thank you for giving a space to emerging writers, especially South Asian writers. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to episode 66 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bart. Thank you for tuning in. Today's Desi Craft Chat was with Wajahat Ali discussing his debut memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From. Episode 67 will be up shortly. Follow on Twitter at Desi Books, Instagram at Desi.books, Facebook at Desi Books FB. Tag the accounts if you have requests or suggestions. Please go to the website if you'd like to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. That's DesiBooks.co. And please share this interview via social media so we can keep raising the tide of Desi literature. Stay healthy, keep reading, and write well.